This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Before Woods Hole was an international science center, it was a hub of maritime commerce. During the 19th century, whaling, fishing, and the guano trade were the mainstays of the village. Between 1863 and 1889, the Pacific Guano Company employed nearly 200 people in Woods Hole and was responsible for getting the railway extended down from Bourne. But the role of Peruvian cormorant excrement often goes unnoticed as a force in the history of Woods Hole, and our little village isn't alone in that. Historians have often overlooked the importance of the guano trade in global industrialization and the modernization of agriculture. That's one of the central arguments in a new eco-history of the guano trade. It's called Guano and the Opening of the Pacific World, a Global Ecological History. The author is Dr. Gregory Cushman, Associate Professor of International Environmental History at the University of Kansas, and he joins me now in our Woods Hole studio. Greg Cushman, welcome to Living Lab.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, this book is a monster. What gave you the idea to write about the eco-history of guano, and how long did it take you to finish this book?
Well, I didn't set out even to write a dissertation about guano. This started out long ago in my graduate work. I was studying Latin American environmental history and knew I wanted to understand more about humanity's relationship to the environment over time in this vast region, but wasn't much more specific than that. I read a book that had a little mention of guano, purely treating it as a commodity with no roots in the natural world at all. And I simply asked the question, I wonder what happened to the birds? What's the story behind this? And went to a database and typed guano into it, and out for the library system where I was studying, and out poured volume upon volume upon volume of journals, of reports, of government documents describing not the old mining industry of guano that you talked about in your introduction that was so important for Woods Hole, but the shepherding of the living guano birds in the 20th century in order for them to poop from year to year in such quantities that it could feed the agriculture of Peru. And then to see the tragedies that would happen when El Niños would come and the fish would go away and the birds would die and the guano production would collapse.
Okay, so let's just for a minute go back to the basics of this guano. In terms of defining it, I mean, is it essentially any bird feces or is it specifically these birds, the cormorants and I guess the boobies that live off the coast of Peru?
Guano is a word most people have heard of, and I have wondered for some time exactly why this is. Guano, technically, comes from a Quechua word, guanu. So this is an English word that actually comes from a Peruvian indigenous language, and in its original meaning meant any kind of excrement that could be used as fertilizer. And actually, the modern meaning of guano does continue to have some of that, but we've restricted it more to mean any flying creature. So birds or bats, their excrement is called guano in English.
According to that definition, guano could come from anywhere in the world. But when we think of guano, we tend to think of the Pacific coast of Peru and some of these islands just off the coast of Peru. Set the scene for us a little bit. What do these islands look like? What else is there besides piles of guano?
One of the things that's notable about these islands is how desolate they are. If it's not nesting season, they will be completely deserted, dry, barren, sandy rocks, separated from the coast by anywhere from a few to a dozen miles. But when during nesting season, especially when the bird populations are high, can be covered, almost every square inch of the island will be covered with birds. So the reason they're so special is because they are isolated from the coast. So there's no foxes or cats or other animals that can eat the birds. The birds come out there for sanctuary, but the real riches are underneath the waves surrounding the islands. The reason Peru is so important is it's one of the most productive marine upwelling ecosystems in the entire world. The numbers of anchovies, sardines, squid, tuna, bonito, sperm whales, etc., that have lived in these waters is astronomical. And the richness of the guano is directly related to the richness of the fishing.
This area of the world around Cape Cod clearly has a long history of being a rich fishing ground. And there are stories from hundreds of years ago where, you know, you could basically walk on the backs of cod. And we have cormorants here. So why do we not have this kind of buildup of guano that you see in the Peruvian islands? What makes it so unique that you get, I mean, deposits that can be meters thick of bird poop?
Up to 150, I think even 200 feet thick was how big they are. One word, rain. Peru is also host to the driest and the oldest desert in the entire world, the Atacama. Up here, and in many other regions that have large bird and fish populations, it's simply that their colonies, rain falls on the guano and leaches the ammonia out of them. Most of us are familiar with the smell of ammonia that we use in cleaners in the house. Ammonia dissolves very readily into water and evaporates, and the bad smell we associate with pigeon droppings under the bridge or other places is actually the ammonia gassing off, or if it's been rained on, actually washing out. The ammonia is so limited in nature that there are creatures ready to grab it whenever it's made available. And the thing that's distinct about Peru is it has so little rain that the guano and the nitrogen just sit there waiting, in some cases for millennia, before they're recycled into natural systems.
Well, I was actually reading some early history of Woods Hole with relation to the Pacific Guano Company that did operate here for about 40 years. And it turns out that, in fact, they were kind of going to extremes. They actually were not using the guano that was this very rich guano closer to the coast. They were going to an island further off the coast where it rains a lot and actually getting, I guess you could say, watered down. But the guano, after a lot of the nutrients have already been leached out of it, bringing it by shiploads back here to Woods Hole, and then bringing in ships of other nutrients that then, in the processing, had to be added back into the guano.
The Woods Hole guano industry is fascinating because of the way that it combines several industries. The bags of guano that were sold on the markets here in Massachusetts, Daniel Webster, the famous statesman for the 19th century, was well known for buying the genuine Peruvian fertilizer and applying it to his fields, and he actually even raised llamas in his estate here nearby, celebrating his connection to the world. Entrepreneurs here in the northeast coast of the United States couldn't get in on the monopoly that a British company had with the Peruvian guano trade, and so went elsewhere trying to find it, and they were quite successful. In fact, the very first overseas territories that were officially colonized by the United States and turned into territory of the United States were small little guano islands in the Caribbean and in the Pacific. And these places, as you mentioned, frequently have rains, and so just the phosphate would be left behind. The Peruvian guano is so valuable because it not only has lots of nitrogen, it also has lots of phosphate, and a couple percent of it is potassium. So it was one of the only truly complete fertilizers, and certainly one of the only concentrated fertilizers that one could purchase back in the 19th century before we began synthesizing these things in factories.
Yeah, I mean, so if you buy a fertilizer today, it always has three numbers on it that are the nitrogen, the phosphorus, and the potassium. And the guano, especially from these dry islands, just had all three of those packed in there naturally.
Yeah, so for gardeners out there, it would be 1222 on the NPK scale.
Obviously, indigenous Peruvians, perhaps thousands of years ago, didn't have those three numbers and the names for it, but they recognized what they had. And in fact, guano is a part of the mythology of this area. In the beginning of the book, you actually start with an ancient Peruvian creation legend or myth that basically comes back to guano. I wonder if you could kind of tell us a short version of that story.
Certainly. Back in the beginning, there was a woman named Cuyaca, who was the most beautiful woman in the world. She was so beautiful that all the men and also all of the gods desired her. Cuniraya Viracocha, the trickster, also desired her and saw her one day weaving under a lucuma tree. And he turned himself into a bird, symbolically, and flew up to the branches and then plopped his semen down into a fruit that fell next to her. She saw the fruit and she devoured it and became pregnant, but did not know who the father was. One year after the birth of this magical child, she called together all of the men and all of the gods onto the high mountain peaks to ask them who the father was. And she sent her child from one man to another, and the child would look at them to see who was his real father. Finally came to the end of the line, to the most ragged, louse-ridden beggar of the whole line. And as it turned out, this was Cuniraya Viracocha, who often dressed in this way to symbolize the wealth that could come from dirtiness. When the child identified this as her real father, she was horrified and immediately yelled out, "How can this be that a beggar would be the father of my child?" And she ran off towards the coast. Kuriraya Viracocha at this moment realized his error and suddenly changed himself into his true golden raiment as a god and called out to her and says, "Look at me now. I am beautiful." But by that time, she had run off. And so he went questing after her along through the mountain valleys and towards the coast, looking for her wherever he could think. And to any creature or any being that he ran up to, he asked her, "Have you seen Koyaka?" If they answered affirmatively, then he would bless them. But if they answered him negatively, he would curse them. He finally arrived down at the coast and met with the two daughters of Urpiwachak, she who gives birth to birds, who in this ancient legend also is responsible for inventing fishing. At this time in history, there were no fish in the ocean. They only lived in small pools where they were raised by Urpiwachak and her daughters to eat. Urpiwachak had apparently gone off into the ocean to see Kuiyaka and her child, who, as this legend tells, had turned actually into guano islands where birds were raised. Kuriraya Viracocha asked the daughters, "Where is Urpiwachak? Where is Kuiyaka?" And they told him, "We don't know. They're way out in the ocean." And as Viracocha often did when he heard this, and he'd be given a negative answer, he actually attacked the two girls, who flew off towards the ocean and turned into birds, thus Urpiwachak meaning she who gives birth to birds. They flew off to find their mother out at sea and told her of the devious way that Kuniraya Viracocha had treated them. Urpiwachak, when she heard this, was furious and flew back towards the coast and arrived at the beach and saw Kuniraya Viracocha walking along. She came up behind him, and Kuniraya Viracocha asked, "What is it, sister?" She says, "Oh, Kuni, it's okay. I just want to preen off your lice," which makes no sense to us, but indicates that he again is ridden with lice and indicates that he's also a bird, because what better for two birds in courtship to do than to preen one another bird of lice? So Urpiwachak comes up, and as she's preening him of lice, is also using her wings to erode the cliffs and to create a giant chasm in which she's planning to throw off Kuniraya Viracocha. He sees his danger, however, and then thinking fast says to himself, "Sister, hold on a minute. I really need to go relieve myself."
Now,
as it's translated.
Right, you say that's the English translation of the ending, which apparently loses something in translation. The original was, perhaps we would say, less couth and is not something we can actually say on the air. But I mean, that story ties together so many things. You know, it's such an old story and yet ties together the fish in the sea, the birds, and as you say, the richness that I guess to modern sensibilities could come from filth, essentially, that they recognized what they had in the guano there.
And even beyond that, this is something important for the ethical relationship that people, ancient Peruvians, had with the natural world. The fact that this person could give birth to the actual guano island and become it themselves, and this other person could actually give birth to birds, and then these people. And the story, the end of the story, is actually then how the tellers of the story come into being. These are all the forefathers and foremothers of the coastal people who live in the vicinity of Lima. And the lesson one would get from the story is not only what value you can get from lice or get from excrement, it's also that we are the kin of the fish of the sea and of the birds of the air. And so to mistreat these creatures, you would be mistreating your own cousins.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Dr. Greg Cushman, author of a new eco-history of the guano trade. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Dr. Greg Cushman, associate professor of international environmental history at the University of Kansas and author of Guano and the Opening of the Pacific World, a Global Ecological History. Before the break, we were talking about millennia ago, essentially the indigenous Peruvian people and their beliefs and their ties to the ecology of the fish and the birds and the guano, that this is all a cycle that they were very aware of and taking advantage of, but in a very responsible way. And I guess the first real challenge that that faces in the first kind of transition is when the conquistadors, the Spanish, finally arrive in South America and the first introduction of Europeans to guano. You tell in the book this story of Don Pedro Guaneque, is that?
Or Guaneque.
Who is a guano lord, a 16th century guano lord. What was a guano lord?
He was a chieftain, or a curaca, to use the Quechua term, who was the head of an entire lineage that lived in a coastal valley. The Inca kings were the kings over these curacas. So to an extent, we'd see him as a lesser king. In this particular case, his identity and the well-being of his people were intimately tied up with these fish living in ponds on the coast, with fish living in the ocean, with agricultural fields, and with the guano that they used to fertilize this. At the time of the conquest, one thing that's important to recognize is that the Inca were the heads of an empire in which they had progressively over the previous century or two conquered vast reaches of the Andean world and colonized peoples, many of whom even spoke different languages, and did so against their will. One thing that we know is that the Inca actually appropriated guano for themselves to an extent and created a rule that modern conservationists often quote with satisfaction, that if any person went to the guano islands and were to hurt a bird or to take guano without permission, that they would be killed as a consequence. One of the things that's often not read into this is that the Inca were actually saying any of the old guano lords who actually had possession of the guano before, they can't take it without a permission anymore and will be killed. So the Spaniards aren't the first group to bring coercive tactics to this.
We're talking about here multiple occurrences of essentially imperial takeover and coveting this resource, but you actually coin a term, neo-imperialism. What do you mean by that?
Neo-ecological imperialism is the word I use, and it's one of the things that the book discusses are the various ways in which empire has impacted the natural world. So we have the Inca, we have Don Pedro Guaneque, who actually is given a coat of arms by the Spanish king with guano birds and guano islands in it, in part in recognition of his loyalty to the new colonial order. Then years later, we have the discovery of guano by scientists like Alexander von Humboldt, who demonstrate its fertilizing value to the scientific community and to progressive farmers in Europe, and who then begin to desire this most valuable of natural fertilizers on Earth. Neo-ecological imperialism is a concept that I develop in the book that attempts to understand what happens during the period that follows the initial conquest and colonizations of new lands. So we have the famous example of Cortes arriving in central Mexico, of Pizarro arriving on the coast of Peru. After you've robbed the gold and the silver from these places and you begin to establish what you a new society, how then does the society go about continuing to prosper? In the case of Mexico and Peru, simply went looking for more things to mine, guano being one of those things, but silver being the most famous one of all. Neo-ecological imperialism is a concept that especially is valuable for understanding how nation states like the United States of America, like Australia, like New Zealand, founded by settler colonists, maintained their prosperity in the world. There's also the story of conquest and dispossession that happens there. But what happens, for example, here in Plymouth, which is actually tell a little bit of a story in the book about how my own ancestors arriving back in the 17th century and then marching in a destructively all the way from sea to shining sea, that some Cushmen stayed behind here in Massachusetts. One who eventually became lieutenant governor of the state and who became an advocate of guano. Guano was interest of him because it could be used to remedy the degradation of the soils that the early generations of colonists settled in Massachusetts had done, and to revivify or renew the earth itself so that Massachusetts as an agricultural land could have a golden age once again. The neo-ecological imperialism comes into this because this particular person, Henry Wiles Cushman, where was he going to get guano? Was coming from the other side of the world, perhaps even bought from the Woods Hole Guano Company. The imperialism here is because the way in which actually he was renewing the soils here locally and other people like him in other parts of the world was by exploiting environments far, far away and shipping those nutrients in that case, or it could also be whales and whale oil or any other of these articles to make life in this other place. So it's neo because it follows as in historically from the older or more original forms of imperialism and colonization. But it's ecological because the exploitation of nature is just as important to this later stage as it was for the earlier. And as I note in the book, the exploitation of phosphates from guano islands in the Central Pacific was absolutely pivotal to Australians and New Zealanders being able to continue to fertilize their fields of wheat, and in particular to fertilize the pastures of their sheep that, of course, even today we buy lamb in the supermarket coming from New Zealand that wouldn't be possible to raise there without continually renewing the soils there.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Dr. Greg Cushman about the history and ecology of the guano trade. Now, we have kind of jumped ahead into this 19th century era, which is kind of called the guano age. And in fact, the golden age of guano was just the second half of the 19th century, 40, 50 years, really quite a short period. But in that time, guano, you know, mentioned whale oil, probably had, it seems, at least as much influence on economics, politics, war, social values in that period of time. We don't think of fertilizer as having that kind of reach, but it really did. And that all kind of came about because, as you were mentioning, Alexander von Humboldt, kind of the first contact, brings this back to Europe. And they had to actually establish what it was about guano that was valuable. Tell us how that kind of evolved, how the understanding of what guano was and how rich it was actually came about.
Well, this is one of the moments in which modern science had a payoff. In this case, Alexander von Humboldt's explorations of many parts of South America, of Mexico, and a brief visit even here to North America to meet Thomas Jefferson, brought back thousands of samples of especially plants, but also articles from local cultures, animals, and minerals, including guano. Guano was the first thing that he and his colleagues in Paris, the center of scientific culture in the Western world at that moment, made a careful analysis of in the chemical labs there and discovered that it had very high quantities of what they called ammonia, but from our present perspective, we call reactive nitrogen. And immediately began looking around to see other places in the world where they could get this because they understood, and Humphrey Davy, another father of excrement chemistry, if you want to call it that, Humphrey Davy, so important in influencing the use of fertilizers in modern agriculture, did a number of experiments on guano and actually used guano to help convince farmers, like Daniel Webster would be an example, someone who would have read his works, that adding concentrated fertilizer to their fields, following the dictates of this new science, could help them straight out with their bottom line.
So how did this transform agriculture? You're talking about having to actually convince farmers that they perhaps didn't even realize that this was a necessity or a benefit.
Well, farmers knew good and well, ancient Peruvians and even early modern Brits and people from the new United States of America, that manure was good fertilizer. But which manures are the best? Science provided an ability to measure this. When someone is actually going to the trouble of trying to make a profit off of every single thing on their farm, including how much it costs to ship manure from some other place to their farm, and if they want the most concentrated one that they can find. Guano had such an impact because of how concentrated it was and how relatively inexpensively it could be shipped from the farthest, most remote islands in the tropical world here to places like Massachusetts or to the to industrializing Great Britain.
And you say that the availability of this concentrated fertilizer generated a fundamental shift in farming from a focus on efficiency to a focus on throughput. I guess they didn't have to be as efficient now that they had this abundance available to them.
That's definitely a critical point. The adoption here of of what's something still highly valued by organic farmers, an organic fertilizer, because it was coming from somewhere else in the world, far, far away, changed the recycling practices that had been the basis of sustainable farming practice anywhere it would have been practiced in the world for centuries, for millennia. Now you could go to the store and buy the fertilizer. Where it came from didn't really matter as much. Another thing that's important here, too, it's actually what the guano was being used to raise. One of my most interesting findings, and tells us something about the change in our diets that go along with this, is that guano was predominantly used, particularly in Britain, to raise things like turnips, sugar beets, rutabagas, and other things like that, which we might be thinking, well, what's the importance of this? These were to place on pastures. Guano was used overwhelmingly to produce cattle feed. What was this cattle feed being used for? In particular, for beef cattle. So the roast beef that is so famous, such a famous part of the Sunday meal in a well-to-do or middle-class British family, the ability to actually have a large beef roast was tied up with the transformation of British farming.
So it was actually being used to, in a way, subsidize the most energy and resource-intensive version of agriculture, and that's obviously creating beef. It wasn't just creating lettuce or spinach or tomatoes directly for people to eat.
That's exactly right. And where was all the grain being grown and a lot of these other things? Grown out in Kansas, where I live and work now. Grown in Argentina, grown in other parts of the world. So it actually enabled Britain to become a beef-producing place rather than a food-producing place.
Now, it's interesting, the link from guano being a fertilizer, revolutionizing agriculture seems fairly logical. But you also write about this range of other things. And of course, being a source of nitrogen, the guano was also used to create explosives.
Well, this is something, again, that how did I become interested in this subject? I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, and we would often go to Mammoth Cave National Park or to Cumberland Caverns State Park to go exploring. And along the way, one of the things that was interesting was, besides seeing bats and things like that, was to see these old beds with pipes that had been built in the middle of the caves deep down in order to process bat guano. This was done by Southern soldiers during the middle of the Civil War in order to produce gunpowder. They were cut off from the best gunpowder supplies and went to the caves of the South to try to make up for it. Not a lot of guano was actually been used for making gunpowder, in part because there are other places we can get nitrogen, although here Peru is very important in this story. One of the things that's amazing is that the presidents and ruling class of Peru weren't particularly concerned by the prospect that the guano was going to be all mined out in the 1870s. People knew it was about to disappear. In fact, they went into massive foreign debt with banks in Britain and Europe in order to raise money. But they weren't concerned that the thing that was funding the whole national economy was going to run out. And the reason being is that another substance, also rich in nitrogen, but a mineral substance in this case, had been discovered in the southern deserts of Peru. The reason it's there is very much the same reasons that guano's there. It's because it's so extremely dry that it never gets used up by other creatures in the environment. The vast nitrate fields of the Atacama could be used much more directly in the production of gunpowder and other explosives than guano could. They required less processing, and thus, let's go straight to the nitrates and use the guano for fertilizer. The history of explosives is eminently tied up with this, because before the discovery of these huge natural deposits of nitrates, and Peru had, much like Bolivia does today with lithium supplies that go into the batteries for our cell phones and for our automobiles, hybrid automobiles, had an overwhelming majority of the world's supplies in this very dry desert. These nitrates, the opening of them to exploitation from the outside, broke a bottleneck in the global nitrogen supply. At one time, it had been very limited, something you had to actually even scrape off the walls of your barn cellar if you lived in a humid part of France to get nitrates to then make gunpowder, or you had to go to the bat caves to get it. Here, suddenly, they could be processed in vast quantities on an industrial scale. Gunpowder was so valuable before the 19th century that it could only be used for gunpowder for guns, and only on occasion when there weren't wars, and how often is that? could be used for mining and things like this. These vast nitrate supplies on the coast of Peru created DuPont's fortune. I grew up right next to a DuPont plant in Old Hickory, Tennessee, that actually shipped in these nitrates during World War I in order to produce explosives for the guns that were firing over the sea and in Europe.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Dr. Greg Cushman about the eco-history of guano. We'll talk more about what the mining of guano did to the environment in Peru and how that industry has fared in the 20th century after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Dr. Greg Cushman, Associate Professor of International Environmental History at the University of Kansas. We're talking about the ecological and cultural importance of the guano trade over the past couple of centuries. It's a topic he explores in a history of guano trade called Guano and the Opening of the Pacific World, a Global Ecological History. Now, Greg Cushman, just before the break, you were talking about how, you know, guano wasn't just used as a fertilizer, but actually was used to make explosives, and just how important a commodity that was, particularly in the late 19th century. And it ends up tying into one of the largest wars of the century, the War of the Pacific.
The War of the Pacific started in 1879 between Chile, Bolivia, and Peru. And this is one of the largest wars fought in the entire 19th century, anywhere in the world, by the way, over who would possess the guano and nitrate resources of the Atacama Desert and the coast. To make a long story short, Chile started the war and Chile won. And Chile became far more prosperous than Peru and Bolivia, in part because of its possession of these things. These nitrates then were used for fertilizer itself. Guano was completely used up during this era, also as fertilizer. But nitrates were increasingly used in various parts of industry. They're used to produce sulfuric acid, one of the workhouse chemicals of the chemical industry. They're used to produce nitroglycerin, range of explosives. And the invention of the industrial process for producing nitrogen chemicals that we use today, the Haber-Bosch process, was inspired because Germany, operating at the beginning of the 20th century, realized if it ever went to war and was cut off from the nitrate supplies of no longer Peru, but now Chile, if it was cut off from these nitrate supplies, that it wouldn't be able to fight at all. And so they invented an industrial means to take nitrogen straight out of the air, using massive amounts of fossil fuel energy to do so, that was so successful that it became the basis for our modern fertilizer and explosives industry today. Now we get it straight out of the air, although at an enormous energy cost.
You mentioned that, you know, during this period of intense mining and use of guano in the second half of the 19th century, there was very little concern about the depletion of these resources. By the turn of the 20th century, we're seeing a change in attitude. There is now some concern, and actually the imposition of government measures, conservation measures, and I would say in terms of the modern environmental movement, some of the first kind of inklings of what has become our modus operandi at this point of government regulation in order to conserve natural resources. And it had a large influence on some of the founders of the modern environmental movement, including Aldo Leopold.
We often don't think of Peru as, or does anyone think of Peru as, one of the beginning points of the modern environmental movement. But when one looks closely at guano, I think that case can be made. The Peruvian government at the turn of the 20th century, after the guano had almost all disappeared, still thought, well, is there a way that we can make use of the living birds and establish what has been called by northern conservationists the world's greatest industry based on the conservation of wild animals in history? They establish a company to carefully shepherd these guano birds that, in order to use sustainably the guano produced from year to year for local agriculture, for Peruvian agriculture. This was extraordinarily successful. Simply by preventing people from bothering the birds, the bird population increased by fivefold over the first half of the 20th century and went from to at its peak in the 1950s, the Peruvian guano industry, 50 million birds nesting on these islands produced almost 300,000 metric tons of guano a year. That's a gigantic quantity. 300,000 automobile size and automobile weight portions of guano were being produced by living birds each year that then basically was the engine of Peruvian intensive agriculture, enabled Peru to export sugar, cotton, and also produce a whole lot of food.
Well, and it wasn't just in Peru. You know, we were talking about how much guano influenced the development of agriculture in the 1800s, but it was also a critical part of Mexico's Green Revolution.
Mexico saw what Peru was doing and simply said, I wonder if we can do this too, and established a project at the beginning of the 1940s in order to build up food supplies. And the hope was to prevent famine and to reduce hunger in this country. Actually came up with a plan that they were going to import hundreds of thousands of eggs from the guano birds of Peru and put them in the nests of other cormorants off the Gulf of California, off of Baja, with the hopes that the Peruvian birds would take over. Back in those days, that was considered good conservation policy. We have kind of changed our attitudes now. The only reason that this program wasn't followed was simply because a big El Nino came right about this time, and the bird population in Peru collapsed for a few years, and so there weren't any eggs to give to Mexico. Mexico decided to try to make do with its local birds, but then figured out pretty quick, you know, the marine environment here just simply isn't as productive as the one off of Peru. We need to come up with something else. And the path that they took was to exploit their huge natural gas and petroleum reserves and establish an industry to synthesize nitrogen fertilizers using fossil fuel energy. I don't know if New England has Fertimex, has taken over any of the local factories here, but you will see in the Great Plains where I live, and especially in the southern United States, Fertimex on the sides of the fertilizer factories, because this program was so successful that the Mexican industry has actually been buying into the U.S. industry for this industrial production of fertilizer.
Now, there's also something that you've termed the Blue Revolution that took place kind of concurrently, middle of the 20th century, and it's essentially the rise of marine fisheries. Talk about how that impacted guano production and the guano trade.
Well, the Green Revolution refers to a dramatic transformation in the productivity of farming based on new varieties of plant crops, especially of wheat or rice, but also requiring lots of inputs, water and fertilizer, in order to make it work. So Mexico's Green Revolution is built on these inputs. We also have, at the same time, and the exact same thinkers and the exact same policymakers looking to the oceans as also being a place that can provide far larger quantities of food if we simply use our scientific and technological know-how to learn to make the seas produce more. And in the case of Peru and also in Mexico and many other places in the world, third world countries look to the ocean as a means to help with their national development. The idea here being, if they could establish industrial fisheries, like the industrial fishery here of New England or of the coast of California, that they could not only produce more food, the hope was to feed the poor of their countries, but also create industries that would grow the economy. In the case of Peru, this was spectacularly successful. Peru went from not having an export industry at all to being the largest producer of fish in the entire world in the course of a single decade.
And as a result, as you were mentioning at the very beginning of the show, that, of course, is the food supply for these guano birds. So as you're pulling those fish to be food for humans, you're pulling the rug out from underneath a different industry.
And that is the of many tragedies in this story is probably the greatest one. This industrialization campaign was extraordinarily successful in terms of actually building entire cities where there had been none before, providing jobs for highlanders who came down to the coast to work, but at the same time was exploiting the food of the guano birds. This is something that the industrialists and Peruvian government were actually laid out the choice. Do we choose guano birds or fish meal? Most of these fish is being actually used to produce fish meal that was used for chicken feed, and they chose fish meal. Fish meal, from the simple economics of it, seemed to be far more lucrative. This was a billion-dollar industry rather than a million-dollar industry, and allowed the guano industry to collapse simply because the birds were competing with fishing boats in order to get these fish.
Now, the collapse wasn't just from the marine fisheries, there's another interesting factor that comes into play in the middle of the 20th century, which is that a lot of these Pacific islands end up being used as test sites for nuclear weapons. And clearly that's not going to have any sort of beneficial impact on birds trying to nest and live there.
Again, the remoteness of these locales made them a target for other use. And also in the case of the British government, when it set out to test its first hydrogen bombs in the 1950s, it had seen the havoc that was raised by the test, the Bravo test on Inuitok and Bikini atolls that the United States had set off earlier in the decade that inspired the Godzilla movies, no less. And so they went, tried to go to as remote a place as they could and to do what they were actually marketing as safe nuclear explosions. Unfortunately, they chose these exact Guano Islands to do this.
Well, and you were saying, you know, earlier, probably because when the birds aren't there, there's nothing there. There's nothing else there besides these birds. And so it probably does seem like a very barren place that you could exploit in this way.
I don't think they were thinking about the birds at all. They were just going there because there weren't any people. Unlike the U.S. tests, which were on islands where people had lived and people were moved off. They set off in the case of Christmas Island, as it's called, Christmas Island, straight south of Hawaii, dozens of nuclear tests on what had been the largest sooty tern colony in the entire Pacific. There were over 10 million birds that nested on this island that actually the soldiers who were there helping run the tests, there were a number of them that where their job was to operate bulldozers to shovel up all of the guano birds that were, if they weren't killed, they weren't killed, but they were blinded by the blast. And since you need your eyes to be able to see the fish in order to fish, basically were destined to wander and starve to death. And so they piled these birds in giant bird cemeteries there on Christmas Island. This is something that was almost unknown. I only discovered because of a mention of it in the conservation literature, but it was certainly the worst of the crimes against nature, I guess, you can see in this project.
Yeah, very cruel end for those birds. Now, put all this together, the fishing, the nuclear testing, the mining of guano, then in 1972, to top it all off, a very strong El Nino year, and we see complete collapse, essentially, of the guano trade and the guano industry.
1972 is a year that's important not just for fish meal and guano, but for world history. We tend to remember the Arab oil crisis of 1973 and 74 as the thing that was really important in this. But that sense of crisis actually was already there before the Arab oil embargo even happened. That's because this large El Nino stressed not only the fishery of Peru, but also agriculture in different parts of the world. The wheat crop in the Soviet Union had some trouble because of this El Nino event. There was a devastating famine in the Sahel region of northern Africa that was also associated with this. And scientists realized that these were connected. One of the things that's extraordinary about this event is the destruction that it caused. The fishmeal industry collapsed, even though scientists tried to do their very best to keep it on a sustainable basis. The guano industry had already been allowed to run its course. Scientists, and I think I want to actually give a happy ending to this story to some extent, at least in terms of our consciousness of the power that humans have and also the power that nature has to get in the way of some of our aspirations. Scientists discovered that the El Nino phenomenon can have a tremendous impact on human livelihoods all over the globe, in part because of the collapse of the fishmeal industry. And I've also studied in my other work the history of the science of El Nino and what happened at oceanographic institutions like Scripps in Southern California and like Woods Hole here in New England, inspired by this desire to understand better what the oceans are doing and how they impact interacting with the atmosphere. So there's actually a story for science that's done here locally that's tied up with this. But the limits to growth, this famous book that came out in 1972, put together mainly by a group of MIT graduate students and by the Club of Rome, convinced the world, because it didn't need that much convincing, that the whole world was going to run up against resource limits in the very near future, if not immediately, unless started to think differently about the way that we used resources and the way in which our growth of populations and our growth of consumption was increasing exponentially, while things like guano cannot be increased really much at all unless they're carefully shepherded.
You mentioned, you know, we're talking about the role of the natural world, El Nino, in this collapse, as well as the human activities. And I wonder if you could forecast for us briefly here, is there a future for the guano trade? Is there any need for it still? And do we have any sense what climate change might do to these birds and to the economy that they drive?
Well, one thing is to keep in mind where the things that we consume now and today, each of us, where they come from. The chicken that we eat still to this day eats a lot of fish meal. And a lot of that fish meal comes from places like the coast of Peru. So when you think about how much energy goes into producing that fish meal and then to bring it this far away and then to give it to chickens and then to ship the chickens to where we're going to eat them and all these sort of things, you can see how our relationship to places like Peru is still part of the problem with regard to the impact that we're having on the environment because of production of greenhouse gases, for example. Another aspect of the tragedy of this story, and I think this is the greatest tragedy of all, is that the new livelihoods that developed as a part of the story through the discovery of guano, of nitrates, of the Haber-Bosch process, the use of fish meal to produce meat, to make our lives better, is, as we well know, having an impact on the atmosphere. That's a whole other story. I know global warming is being caused by these things. It's the basic bottom line. It's a consensus of the scientists I work at Kansas and the consensus of scientists here at Woods Hole and many other places. Who is going to suffer first and suffer most from the global environmental changes that are going to happen? It's going to be the inhabitants of these small islands scattered across the Pacific, many of them atolls that may be only a couple of feet above sea level. Even very modest levels of sea level rise, levels that new models, ice scientists are beginning to suspect may happen during the lifetime of my young children, within a century or two centuries even, that these homes to these birds that were the basis for the guano industry and for the enrichment of the industrial world may actually be buried underneath the ocean. And of course, it's not just the birds, but it's also the peoples that live on these islands that live next to, among these guano birds, and the story that we told earlier in the broadcast. One of the reasons that they're there is because they learned from mistakes like we are making, and learned to live in a more sustainable way with the creatures that they considered their cousins living in their surroundings.
Many, many more lessons that we can learn from guano. You can explore them all in Dr. Gregory Cushman's new Eco-History of the Guano Trade called Guano and the Opening of the Pacific World, a Global Ecological History. Greg Cushman, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, before we wrap things up, we want to share some news with you. A few weeks ago, we spoke with those involved in a recent message-in-a-bottle story. The bottle in question was found by a Canadian seal researcher on Sable Island off the coast of Nova Scotia. It was released 56 years ago by Woods Hole oceanographer Dean Bumpus as part of a 16-year-long project whose goal was a better understanding of ocean currents along the East Coast. We figured that was the last we'd hear of messages in a bottle for a while. But we were wrong. And in fact, this next story hits even closer to home. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has announced that a beachcomber on Martha's Vineyard recently recovered a bottle released 55 years ago by their predecessors, the Coast and Geodetic Survey. The bottle was part of an investigation of the movement of floating material originating at three sites in New England's waters proposed as atomic waste dumping sites. NOAA researchers have speculated that this may be the last of the Coast and Geodetic Survey's bottles ever to be found. Of course, the same thing was said 3 years ago when a bottle turned up in Alaska. Either way, the discovery has prompted folks at NOAA to dig into their own extensive history of using drifted bottles for oceanographic research. We've added this latest find to our interactive timeline of scientific messages in bottles. You can find that and more on our website, capeandislands.org. You'll find Living Lab in the program menu. And of course, you can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.